Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. I'm so glad you're here with us tonight, coming to you from the southern Mississippi, just north of the Gulf Coast. The solar wind tonight is 490.7 kilometers per second. There are four sunspots, but none of them pose a threat for flares. Don't be too alarmed, but a coronal mass ejection hit Earth's magnetic field yesterday, sparking a G2 class geomagnetic storm and northern lights as far south as Wisconsin and Minnesota in the United States. The NOAA forecasters estimate a 25% chance of more storming today as the disturbance subsides. There is also a huge prominence on the limb of the sun rotating our way. Now, these big ones are unpredictable and potentially very powerful. We don't really have any history to tell us that they're very stable. They can do anything. They can explode. They can lash out into space. They can flail high energy protons toward the Earth. So we should be ready for anything. Have your foil hats ready. Most people know you can do just about anything you want in Denmark. Well, soon you will be able to add a quick ride into space. That's right, a private Danish rocket launched into the sky today, actually a couple days ago, on its first successful test flight. A trip that didn't reach anywhere near space, but did mark a huge step forward for the team's plan to eventually loft people on cheap suborbital space flights. The rocket only went 2 miles, a paltry 61 miles short of space, but it marks a strong success for the small company, and we'll keep you posted on that. It'd be kind of fun to take a cheap and fast round-trip ticket to space in a single day, splashing down in the sea off the coast of Norway. There were 21 earthquakes in the last 24 hours, with 7 of them above 5.0. One was over 6.3 west of Macquarie Island. And by the way, there's no seismic activity worth speaking about, nothing over 2.0 along the New Madrid Fault. So rumors of tremors have been greatly exaggerated. If there were any, they have all ceased by now. Weather has still been doing some strange stuff. Twisters near Boston and Massachusetts, go figure on that one. And record highs in the southeast with snow in the west. And it's June, people. It's June. Snow on top of snow in the mountains. Some of it is melting, which is expected to fill all the lakes south of that, going down the Snake River, Colorado River, etc., etc. So those people that live in Southern California will have no shortage of water this year. Lake Mead is expected to come up 17 or 18 feet, which will just about return it to the days of old as a recreational lake. Right now, it's a puddle compared to what it normally is. If you live in these areas and you're facing unusual weather situations, you may be called upon to evacuate from time to time. And if you're called upon to evacuate, the smart thing to do is to be prepared. And that's why you should visit our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com. My good friend Paul Faust and his firefighter buddies in New York have formed this company to package and sell to you emergency preparedness items. Now, yeah, you can go to Walmart, you can go to the hardware store, you can buy some of this stuff if you know what you're doing, and you can put together a homemade kit for probably a little more money. Or you can visit Paul's website at 1-800-PREPARE.com, get it all packaged in a nice, neat red package that you know is ready to grab and go, or ready to stick in your vehicle. And that way, if you have to evacuate, you won't be a burden upon FEMA. You will be able to take care of yourself. Our phone lines are going to be open all night tonight, and I'm going to give you the subject matter right now before I give you the phone numbers. We were going to talk about the science of genetically engineered food. Now, there has been all kinds of sensationalism out there, and if you listen to the other conspiracy programs out there, you're scared to death. I recently heard that one of the most dangerous places on earth is your local grocery. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense, people. Don't be afraid to go to the grocery, but please go informed and know this. It is your economic buying power that controls everything. And so we are going to cover genetically modified foods, but something came up in the news last night that went along with something that we predicted was going to happen about a year ago. Well, we didn't predict that it was going to happen a year ago. We predicted it was going to happen a year ago. And now it has happened. China has divested itself of 97% of the short-term debt, U.S. debt, that it has purchased. Now, this is economic science, and it's going to take a little bit of math, a little bit of understanding as to what's going on, where did the money go, why did it go there, why is it being done, and what does it mean? This is weekend news, people. Tomorrow morning is Monday. And this isn't going to have just an effect on you and your paycheck and your company's income, whoever you work for. This is going to affect the global economy. You need to know why it happened, who's doing it, and what you can do about it. And that's what we're going to cover. Tonight's phone lines, if you want to be part of the program, is 530-413-4511 if you are off-planet. And we are reviewing... Hold on one moment while I grab the book. I am actually reviewing a book, a new book by Peter Voltaggio, and it's called Business Lessons from an Alien, okay? interesting book, people, really interesting book. I'm not going to review it this week because this news came up and I got involved in this and I just haven't prepared my notes on it. But we're going to have Peter on the program and we're going to talk about it. It will be the closest thing that we have to actually interviewing an alien on this program. I do want you to know that that invitation is open. So if you are not born of this world and you're out there, you can call in with anonymity and complete sanctuary here on X Squared Radio. So the phone number off planet, 530-413-4511. Yeah, I got that text. Okay. I know, I realize I might be the alien. I get it. But we really want to interview an alien here. So that phone line's open. 530-413-4515 if you're east of Earth. And 530-413-4520 if you're west of Earth. Now, you can also listen to X Squared Radio through the BBS Radio Network by dialing with your phone. So you don't have to worry about walking away from your laptop or your PC. You can listen to the program live on your phone, on your Bluetooth. Just dial 712-432-0075 and then the access code 318-116-pound. You'll be part of a conference call. Don't worry about any noise you make in the background because it won't come through. You'll be in listen mode only, but at least you'll be there live. You can still send texts to me through Skype at X2-Radio. That's my Skype name. So if you want to send me text messages through Skype, I will get them during the program. So let's take 40 seconds, take a breather, loosen your seatbelt just a little bit. Okay, it's a little too tight. Lay that seat back. We'll be back in 40 seconds with X2 Radio. China. Very soon will be the number one economy in the world. China has divested 97% of its holdings in U.S. Treasury bills. That was Friday's news, June 3rd, just a couple of days ago. Now, the interesting thing is we kind of saw this coming, okay? I'm going to play a Chinese commercial for you. You're going to hear the Chinese version. I'm going to read the dub to you. You've seen this commercial on TV. It's put out by a citizens watch group, and it is very telling, people. Very telling. So I'm going to read the text of the dub to you while you are hearing the Chinese in the background. It is a Chinese lecturer in the year 2030, and he is giving a history lesson to a theater full of Chinese people who are listening to him make this comment. Internet's going very, very slow right now, so give it a second to come up and we'll get the audio. Okay, here we go. Why do great nations fail? The ancient Greeks, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, and the United States of America. They all make the same mistakes, turning their back on the principles that made them great. America tried to spend and tax itself out of a great recession. Enormous so-called stimulus spending, massive changes to healthcare, government takeovers of private industries, and crushing debt. Of course, we owned most of their debt. And now they work for us.
You can change the future. You have to. Join Citizens Against Government Waste to stop the spending that is bankrupting America.
All right, that's the commercial that you have been seeing on television. Now, that's pretty devastating. I mean, there's really no humor about this, people, because it's real. But unbeknownst to most of the population, only till Friday, China has dropped 97% of its holdings in U.S. Treasury bills, decreasing its ownership of the short-term U.S. government securities from a peak of $210.4 billion in May of 2009, get this, to just $5.69 billion in March of 2011. And this is the most recent month reported by the U.S. Treasury. Now, Treasury bills are securities that mature in 1 year or less. that are sold by the U.S. Treasury to fund the nation's debt. Just to give you, I'm going to give you another audio clip here. This is to explain what's going on. These are financial programs that actually discuss the strategy. What's going on? Why is it going on? Who's doing it? And possibly what the consequences are. This is quite devastating. China is dumping the U.S. dollar and prepares to collect on
the debt. Chinese President Hu Jintao has called for free trade and investment liberalization during his address at the Asia-Pacific Economic Summit in Singapore. The Chinese leader has also put forward a four-point proposal to boost economic growth and revive the world economy. For more on this, I'm now joined by financial expert Max Kaiser, who is in Paris.
Now, before we get to Max, it's really important that you understand what the Chinese leader was saying at this summit. He has a plan for reviving the world economy, and it doesn't include the American dollar. Now listen to what Max has to say.
Hello to you, Mr. Kaiser. Now, is China trying to reduce its dependency on the U.S. as trading partner?
Sure, China would love to reduce its dependency on the U.S., and dependency is a good word. The U.S. dollar has become the opium of international trade, and China is addicted to U.S. opium dollars. Remember, the U.S. loaned China over $1 trillion so that China would be able to export lots of products back to America. But America has absolutely no intention whatsoever of repaying China that $1 trillion. America will never pay China back that $1 trillion, and they're forcing China to buy more dollars to keep their own currency from rising, thus killing their export market. That's why China is buying lots of this stuff, gold bullion. They can't get enough of gold bullion. India's buying gold bullion. China's buying gold bullion as a way to hedge themselves against these things. This is Warren Buffett toilet paper. Warren Buffett toilet paper here, the U.S. dollar. It's going to zero, and China has got itself into a conundrum because their entire economy is based on U.S. consumers buying Chinese products financed by the U.S. Moving a tremendous amount of paper through the system, and that paper is now becoming worthless. Trying desperately to manage their domestic economy and to grow their domestic economy. They're doing lots more trade with countries like Japan and South Korea, again, to get themselves away from this U.S. dollar dependency.
How effective will President Obama's visit to China be in ending the numerous trade snipes between the two countries?
Well, Barack Obama is not going with much in terms of leverage to try to get any of these partners to the table in any meaningful way, unless he wants to sell China California, which I would imagine Governor Schwarzenegger would be ready to sell China California as a way to try to rebalance the incredible imbalances between these two countries. Other than that, or selling China all of America's roads, tunnels, and bridges, or something of value. The only thing Barack Obama has are more dollars. And the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan are happy to just keep printing dollars. And so China's forced to buy dollars as a way to prevent their own currency from rising in terms of their markets. And they're scrambling desperately to get out from underneath this dependency and to recover, to become really, they should start a program in China called Americans Anonymous, which would be a program to get themselves over their dependency and addiction to American dollars and the American economy.
Cashed up and looking for bargains, China's state-owned companies have been spending up big in Australia, buying iron and steel producer Midwest last year for around $1 billion, offering almost $2 billion for a friendly takeover of the debt-ridden Oz Minerals, almost $20 billion for a stake in mining giant Rio Tinto. Both deals might yet be blocked by the Australian government.
China has enough money to spend, more money than it can actually spend.
Two state-owned oil companies in Russia received a $25 billion loan from China. In return, China gets 300,000 barrels a day for 20 years, the biggest energy deal ever between the two countries.
With so many governments and companies strapped for cash, they're turning to the one place that's all cashed up. And along the way, analysts say China is not only buying political influence, but also securing energy and minerals, possibly for decades to come, at a bargain.
Now, this is the ancient Nephilim plan. Hate to take a little aside here, but that's what it is. The actual takeover of the world through economics, through interdependency. Now, for decades, China has been buying the U.S. debt. Now it is time to sell the U.S. debt. And China is bulking up with cash. Being the only country in the world with actual cash. The interesting thing is, when China divests itself of nearly $1 trillion of U.S. debt, who's buying? Where is the money coming from if it's not coming from China? Ah, this is the real interesting thing. Until October, the Chinese were generally making up for their decreasing holdings in treasury bills by increasing their holdings of longer-term U.S. treasury securities. Thus, until October, China's overall holdings of the U.S. debt continued to increase. That was the headline you all were reading. That was the economy that we all understood as we were watching the balance of equity. Equity is actual dollars, actual value in the world. Since October, however, China has also started to divest from longer-term U.S. securities. The interesting thing is somebody is buying it, and there has to be a reason why this is happening. Why is China all of a sudden selling its debt, or selling the U.S. debt? And why at such a rapid pace? Well, it is actually, and I'm going to just put a small A in front of this, actually, it's actually an act of war. Not the kind of war that you're used to reading about. Not the one with soldiers and tanks and planes. I'm talking about the one with economics. The one moving money. The one financing weapons. This is why. Now listen to this.
Planning to wage war on the dollar. Chinese military officers are proposing a sell-off of U.S. bonds.
Now, I don't want to replay that for you, but I'm going to re-say what she said. China's military officers are proposing a sell-off of American debt. Listen closely.
To get revenge on Washington over its latest $6.4 billion arms sale to Taiwan.
Ah, retaliation for a multi-billion dollar sale of weapons to who? To Taiwan. Why would we sell weapons to Taiwan? Who is Taiwan worried about defending itself against? Taiwan's an island. Exactly right. Taiwan is worried about defending itself against mainland China. So Taiwan becomes an ally of the U.S. And the U.S., true to its form as internationally renowned Great Satan, has sold weapons to Taiwan. Retaliation? Not with weapons, with money. This is the Nephilim way. Here we go.
Joining me now is a reporter, Bill Gertz of the Washington Times, who has been covering this story. Mr. Gertz, thank you so much for joining us. Now, it's no secret that China holds more U.S. debt than any other nation, trillions of dollars. They're our primary creditor. So what impact would this have if China does indeed dump these bonds?
Well, it's not exactly clear what would be behind there. Obviously, it would drive interest rates up. It would definitely disrupt the ongoing efforts to try and fix the recession that the administration is going right now. But I think more importantly, it's the idea that the Chinese military is getting involved with this financial issue certainly raises questions about what China's intentions are towards the United States.
What do you believe their intentions are? Would this be a shift in policy of using economic warfare for political gain?
Well, it's very interesting. Back in 2000, there was a book published called Unrestricted Warfare, which kind of laid out this kind of unconventional means of waging both trade warfare and financial warfare. Efforts by the Pentagon to try and get some clarity on those issues were never resolved. In other words, the Pentagon tried to speak with the military. So it's clear that they have this in the back of their mind. On the other hand, U.S. officials have also said that it would be counterintuitive for the Chinese to sell off bonds because it would hurt their economy in the long run.
This has been the long-range strategy for a while, and we raised this question about a year ago here on this program, that China would not take a large-scale sell-off of U.S.-American debt because it would hurt them as bad as it hurts us. But it doesn't if the global economy is on its hind end. You remember in 1929, we had a similar situation in our country. We were practicing isolationism to an unprecedented level. We were starving the rest of the world to death. We wouldn't trade with it. We were self-sufficient, and we were going to stay that way. We had just gotten done finished up with the Great War, and we weren't going to involve ourselves in any other skirmishes anywhere around the planet. Retaliation, economic warfare. What happened? The banks went to Europe, loaned Germany and other countries money in order to pull out of World War I reparations debt. They defaulted on the debt and sunk the American banks. Now, what this did is it drove prices down in the United States. Real estate fell through the floor. Hard goods, commodities, all kinds of things fell through the floor. Deflation. That's why it's called a depression. Then opportunists who had large amounts of cash came in and scooped up all those assets at dimes, pennies on the dollar. Millionaires became billionaires overnight, and we're still dealing with those billionaires today. The Rockefellers, GE, most of the original Dow were post-depression opportunists. Now, all of them, except for General Electric, have gone away and been absorbed into other companies, but that's how it happened. So, if China sells off its debt, somebody buys that debt, China then has the cash to scoop up assets like mining companies, oil companies, iron processing companies, at pennies on the dollar, and that's exactly what they're doing. In case you haven't read the news lately, chain link fences, copper pipe, copper wire are being stripped by pirates. Literally, people in the middle of the night are going and cutting the copper grounds off of telephone poles. They're taking chain link fences down around buildings that are not very well surveilled, and they're selling it for iron. Why? Because China is paying top dollar for stainless steel, iron, copper, and other metals. That is what is occurring here. This is the kind of war that's being fought now, and there's nothing that we can do about it. Keep listening.
Their argument is that the Chinese would be foolish to do this because the U.S. and Chinese economies are so closely intertwined.
Isn't that the case? Why would China want to punish themselves simply to get some revenge on the U.S.? If it's gonna
a lot of people don't understand that China today is still ruled by a nuclear-armed communist dictatorship. And dictatorships, they're very angry over the U.S. arms sale to Taiwan. And this is what's behind the bluster. They did this in the past, back in 2005, when Congress was getting ready to pass some legislation to punish China over its currency valuation issue. So it's not clear whether they'll follow through on it or it's just bluster on the part of the Chinese military.
Now, you mentioned earlier the military leaders getting involved in this kind of different warfare. Do we know how much influence the military leaders have on financial matters? Do they even have the authority to be weighing in on financial policy?
Well, the short answer is no, we don't understand their system. What we do know is that one of the most powerful bodies within China today is the Central Military Commission, which is headed by Hu Jintao, the president, and has two military leaders as its deputies. They're the ones that actually make the real decisions. And of course, in China's system, back when Mao's day, they said political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. That said, we don't have real clarity. There's not a lot of good intelligence information about the decision-making process in China. We do know that the Standing Committee of the Politburo includes about 9 senior Chinese leaders who ultimately make these decisions. But again, it's a very opaque system, so we don't know how those decisions are made.
If they do follow through with this, how much leverage do you think China has? I mean, we know that the U.S. continues to raise the debt ceiling. They'll be selling trillions more in debt this year, while China and the U.S. often have conflicting foreign policy interests. When you look at Iran, for example.
Yeah, there's a number of issues right now which have heightened tensions between the U.S. and China. First, it was the arms sales to Taiwan. It's also the President Obama's upcoming meeting with the Dalai Lama of Tibet. There are also issues regarding Chinese cyber attacks on U.S. corporations, notably Google. So far, this idea of using what they used to call the nuclear option, that is, using China's debt leverage over the U.S., has never really been so much an issue of whether they would do this. It's more an influence measure. In other words, the Chinese are saying, look, we could do this to your economy if you don't go along with the policies that we want.
Well, thank you.
Well, the bottom line is, in the couple of months since this interview took place, and this has not been viewed very much, only 8,000 views on this video, it's kind of hard to find. Since the making of this broadcast, and now, China has done it. So, the debt, as reported by the U.S. Treasury Department, China's ownership of the U.S. national debt has decreased in each of the last 5 months on record, including November, December, January, February, and March, and now April. Prior to the fall of 2008, according to Treasury Department data, Chinese ownership of short-term Treasury bills was modest. And you'll agree with this, standing at only $19.8 billion in August of that year. That was 2008. We had a pretty good economy in 2008. But when President George W. Bush signed legislation to authorize a $700 billion bailout of the U.S. financial industry in October of 2008, and President Barack Obama, inaugurated just 3 months later, signed a $787 billion economic stimulus law in February of 2009, add those two together, people, it's pretty close to $1.5 trillion. Chinese ownership of short-term U.S. Treasury bills skyrocketed. Of course it did, because the debt had to be sold and China bought it. By December 2008, China owned $165.2 billion, up from $19 billion, according to the Treasury Department. And by March of 2009, just 3 months later, Chinese Treasury bill holdings were at $191 billion. And by May of 2009, 2 months after that, a staggering $210.4 billion. However, China's overall appetite for U.S. debt increased still over a longer span than did its appetite for short-term U.S. Treasury bills. In August of 2008, before the bank bailout and the stimulus law, overall Chinese holdings of U.S. debt stood at, this is the overall, this is long-term and short-term combined, $573.7 billion. That's enough to make a serious, serious dent in the world economy. That number continued to escalate past May of 2009 when China started to reduce its holding in short-term treasury bills, and it ultimately peaked at, I know this is going to blow your mind, it's just so much money, it ultimately peaked at $1.17 trillion last October. And as of March of 2011, just a couple months ago, overall Chinese holdings of U.S. debt had decreased to $1.14 trillion. Most of the U.S. national debt is made up of publicly marketable securities sold by the Treasury Department and IOUs. They're called intra-governmental bonds that the Treasury has given to so-called government trust funds, such as, you guessed it, Social Security trust funds, when it has spent the trust fund's money on other government expenses. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, although we have one, to figure out that when you put the two and two together, you connect the dots, you see that the Chinese actually own the U.S. Social Security system. Let me say that again. The Chinese government owns the U.S. Social Security system. The publicly marketable segment of the national debt includes treasury bills and these IOUs. Now, before the end of March 2012, the Treasury must redeem all of the $1.7 trillion in Treasury bills. Ah, by the way, just for the studio in Paradise, California, if you would open up the phone lines, we would most appreciate it. I am getting text messages from people that are saying they're trying to call in and they're getting elevator music. I didn't even know you had an elevator in the studio. But if you guys can get on that, I'd really appreciate it because I know there are lots of people out there that want to weigh in on this. The Treasury must redeem all of the $1.7 trillion in Treasury bills that were extant as March 2011 and find new or old buyers who will continue to invest in the U.S. debt. Ah, but the number two buyer of U.S. debt is who? That's right. It's Japan. And Japan isn't buying right now. They have their own problems. So there's a tactic that's used by monetary funds that the U.S. controls called quantitative easing. Quantitative easing. That's a little bit like a loan from dad. It's typically called QE. So when I use the term QE, you know what I'm talking about. Quantitative easing. It's a loan from dad. It's a monetary policy tool used by some central banks to stimulate their national economies when conventional monetary policy has become ineffective. In other words, when you're broke, when conventional monetary policy, like a paycheck, has become ineffective, you're broke. Then you use central banks to stimulate their national economies. You get a loan from dad. The central bank creates money. The central bank creates money by buying government bonds and other financial assets in order to increase the money supply and the excess revenues or excess reserves of the banking system. This action also raises the prices of the financial assets bought, which lowers their yield, as long as the yield is above zero. And I could play all kinds of things for you that it's at zero, it's at 0.4%, it's at 1%, somewhere around there. They try to keep it just barely above zero. Now, expansionary monetary policy, otherwise known as inflation, normally involves a lowering of short-term interest rates by the central bank. Hang on a second, one more text coming in. Okay. New access code. I don't know what the new access code is, but he has a new one, so it's out there. Look on bbsradio.com, and you'll get the access code for the dial-in. All right. That's for those people that are calling into the conference line. I will change my announcement as soon as I look up that new conference call-in code. The phone number is still the same. But there's a call-in code that you have to dial in order to listen. Now, quantitative easing, QE, may then be used by the monetary authorities to further stimulate the economy by expanding the excess reserves in the banking system and lowering interest rates further out on the yield curve. That's why interest rates are at an all-time low right now. Now, the 2010 fiscal year total of the U.S. interest payment, this is the interest payment, just the interest on the debt. This is not the debt. This is a payment on the principal. This is like a Quicken loan, interest only. $375,247,863,222.70. My question to you, and you can call in because somebody out there knows the answer. I know the answer, but I'm testing you. You can call in at 530-413-4511 off planet. 530-413-4515 east of Earth. 530-413-4520 west of Earth. Here's the question. Who gets the money? Who gets the $375+ billion a year in interest off the U.S. debt? When they get the money, what do they do with it? The reason that this interest money is not available to industry for lending is that the banks, the central banks, are foreign. The countries that are holding U.S. debt are earning profits from the interest. And when the payments stop or the risk of default on that debt gets too great, they will divest themselves of that debt. So if all money owned by all American banks, businesses, and individuals was gathered up today and sent to the U.S. government, believe it or not, there would still not be enough to pay off the U.S. national debt. This is very disheartening. It's sort of like having a home loan on a home that you had appraised, and then a year after you bought it, you had appraised again, and you borrowed 125% of the value of the house as a second mortgage, and then the value of your house plunged. What it means is even if you sold your home, you would not be able to pay off the debt. And the company that you work for is beginning to lay off people. Now you see why the creditor would get a little nervous. Number two, pressure. The only way to create more money is to go into even more debt, which makes the problem even worse. Good money after bad, money down a rat hole, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I'm talking about. You see, this is what the whole Federal Reserve System was designed to do. It was designed to slowly drain the massive wealth of the American people and transfer it to the elite international bankers. This is economic science. This is alchemy. It goes all the way back to the Nephilim, before the Freemasons, before the Templars. This was the design. If you owe more money than ever was created, you can never pay it back. That means perpetual debt for as long as the system exists. It is a system designed to force the U.S. government into ever-increasing amounts of debt because there is no escape. We could solve this problem by shutting down the Federal Reserve and restoring the power to issue U.S. currency to the U.S. Congress, which is what the U.S. Constitution calls for. But the politicians in Washington, D.C. are not about to do that. There have been a couple that have tried. There have been a couple that have tried. Both of them are dead. And I'm talking about presidents. So unless you are willing to fundamentally change the current system, you might as well quit complaining about the U.S. national debt, because it is now, as of this month, mathematically impossible to pay it off. It's impossible. There's not enough money in the system. There's not enough value in the system. The banking process is one of fractional reserves. This is how it works. The bank receives $100 and it can now loan out $1,000. You see, fractional reserve banking works both ways. When $100 is introduced into the system, it can theoretically create $1,000, as the example that I just gave you demonstrates. However, when that $100 is removed, it can have the opposite impact. That's right. $100 removed from the bank has $1,000 worth of impact. In fact, if truth be known, it has $10,000 worth of impact. And considering the fact that the Federal Reserve, quote, purchased the vast majority of new U.S. government debt last year, we've got a real mess in our hands. Now, wait a minute. I thought China was buying the debt. Oh, they were. They were buying the debt. But see, now China's selling the debt. And so the question is, if somebody is selling the debt, China's selling the debt, who's buying? It isn't Japan. They're not in financial condition to buy. They have their own half-trillion-dollar problem with radiation leaks and dead zone shutting down productivity of some of the key things that they need to drive their economy, like computer chips and car parts. They're desperately moving money around to try to solve their economical problems, and they will fix them. Japan will fix them. They're strong enough to do it. But they're not strong enough to continue to buy U.S. debt. So who's buying it? This is the question that begs answering in this hour. Oh, my gosh, it's going to blow your mind. According to CNBC, the Federal Reserve, let me say that again. I don't want to spell it out for you. The Federal Reserve, those central banks, the foreign banks, the ones that are not American, the ones that are not federal and have nothing in reserve. The Federal Reserve bought approximately 80% of the U.S. Treasury securities issued in 2009. In other words, the Federal Reserve has been gobbling up the massive tsunami of U.S. government debt that has been created over the last year. This is absolutely unprecedented, and yet is another clear indication that the U.S. financial system is on the verge of a major economic collapse. You see, the Federal Reserve is not part of the federal government. In fact, the Federal Reserve is about as Federal Express. The Federal Reserve is a private bank owned and operated for profit by a very powerful group of elite international bankers, Nephilim Central. Even if a way could be figured out how to pay off all the debt we owe to foreign banks, such as China, Japan, etc., those are the two big ones still, it would still be mathematically impossible to pay off all the debt we owe to the Federal Reserve, which is exploding so fast that it is hard to even keep track of. Now, I know this blows your mind. It blows mine too. Because this is a CNBC bombshell that let this be known. This is the one that explains the Fed's money scheme. And this interviewer completely stumbled into this in the middle of an interview on a virtually unrelated financial issue. She kind of swerved into it, and the answer was absolutely stunning. Listen to this.
David, PIMCO did an analysis, and we're going to ask Christina Romer about it in a moment, that we had to issue $1.5 trillion of new debt last year in 2009 in this country just to finance our deficit. 80% of that debt was bought by the U.S. Federal Reserve, which means, well, I guess you could use the word Ponzi scheme, but I mean, they're printing the money and buying it.
Wait. What did she say? Ponzi scheme? The Federal Reserve is printing the money and buying it. Oh, my gosh. Now, listen to this guy.
How long can we continue doing that? I mean, is that not something that at some point becomes, you can't have a market that goes up with that situation?
Absolutely, Aaron, and I think that's what we saw with the dollar depreciation and the rise in gold is concerns about our fiscal situation here, and clearly at some point we're going to have to get to a situation where the economy can grow on its own without the support of government stimulus, and you're right, at some point we're going to have to pay that back. I think that's a couple of years down the road. I don't know that for 2010 that that's going to be that big an issue. At some point the Fed's going to have to start removing liquidity. They're going to have to raise rates. That will have an impact on the market and on investor optimism, but I think that's more of a 2011-2012 issue as far as...
Okay, hold on. He said that the Fed would have to start removing liquidity and raise interest rates. Guess what? That's exactly what happened. In October of 2010, just prior to 2011, the Fed removed $3.3 trillion, and they dumped it straight into the credit market. They removed it from the U.S. economy. They just removed it, and they gave it away at 0% interest to do what they call shore up the credit markets. He's exactly right. That's exactly what happened, except they didn't raise interest rates. Big disaster. Listen to this.
2010 goes, I think we can still feel pretty comfortable that as far as economic growth and equity valuations are concerned, we ought to be okay.
Give me one word answers, guys, because we're out of time. When the Fed begins to withdraw its quantitative easing, its exit strategy, is that bad news because higher rates hurt stocks, or is that good news because it means the economy is getting better? Bad or good, Michael?
Good.
David?
Temporarily bad, but ultimately good.
Temporarily bad, but ultimately good. Neither one of those came to pass. Stocks have survived. Gold is going up. Silver has gone up 100% in the last 6 months. 100% in the last 6 months. Because why? Because people are looking for a hedge against this inflation. Because the Federal Reserve is printing money and buying the U.S. debt with the money. It's monopoly money. There's nothing behind it. Nothing. And that's why there's no value in our economy. Now, there's money, but there's no value. There's nothing of substance moving in the system. And that was the bombshell. Now, neither one of these guys on this CNBC interview that took place in 2009 knew that China was going to dump the U.S. Treasury bills on the market in 2011. And that's exactly what happened. Now, just to give you an idea how exactly opposite this was supposed to be. I say it was supposed to be. By design, the campaign under which Obama ran was so radically different to what he is doing now as economic policy. It blows your mind. And now, it's really going to blow your mind because I'm going to play for you right now Obama's own words from the Democratic debates during the campaign in 2008. Listen closely, because you're going to say to yourself, this cannot possibly be the same man. Here we go.
And that we are able to finance health care for Americans who currently don't have it, and that we're able to invest in our infrastructure and invest in our schools. And you can't do that for free, and you can't take out a credit card from the Bank of China in the name of our children and our grandchildren, and then say that you're cutting taxes, which is essentially what John McCain has been talking about. And that is irresponsible. I believe in the principle that you pay as you go. And you don't propose tax cuts unless you are closing other tax breaks for individuals, and you don't increase spending unless you're eliminating some spending or you're finding some new revenue. That's how we got an additional $4 trillion worth of debt under George Bush. That is helping to undermine our economy, and it's going to change when I'm president of the United States.
Ooh, it didn't change when he was president of the United States. He continued to write checks he couldn't cover like he could beat it to the bank. Much higher interest rates on U.S. government debt would cause the U.S. federal budget deficit to absolutely explode, which it has not done. Interest rates on everything else throughout the economy would also have skyrocketed. It didn't. As mortgage rates climbed dramatically, the housing market would completely collapse. Mortgage rates did not climb dramatically, and housing still collapsed. The prediction was that the U.S. economy would be totally in flames, and it is, but not the way that they predicted. But for now, and this situation cannot last forever, the Federal Reserve is keeping interest rates artificially low by lending the U.S. government as much money as it wants at extremely low interest rates. Of course, the Federal Reserve is making an insane amount of money out of the arrangement. So it is working out quite nicely for them as well. But by essentially printing a flood of cheap money for the U.S. government to borrow, the Federal Reserve is ultimately going to end up destroying the value of the U.S. dollar. And that's exactly what has happened. That is what has happened to the U.S. dollar. That is why we are in the situation we are. That is why we have no value in the American dollar. And that is why so many people are out of work, because the companies that need that money in order to build plants, in order to buy equipment, in order to put equity in the system, in order to put inventory in the system, they cannot, because there's no money to move. All the money is tied up in a Federal Reserve. That's why the political science of what is going on in the world is so important right now. First hour of X Squared Radio in the can. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Phone lines will be open. We'll be back in about 5 minutes. Don't go away.
Better. Welcome back to Expert Radio. A little goodbye Milky Way by Enigma. Expert Radio has been on the DBS Radio Network now going into our sixth year. It has been quite an experience. And if you want to have an experience of your own like this, get a hold of me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. I'll see what we can do about getting you on a BBS radio. I'll be happy to sponsor you. My good friend Ramon and his partner are on the radio just before me now on Sunday nights with 100th Monkey Radio. We're so happy to have some of their listeners staying over with us here on X Squared Radio. It's a great pleasure to have you. Great pleasure to have met Ramon and know him from calling into this program, but also met him face-to-face at the ESETI conference, Earth Transformation Conference, a couple of summers ago. That facility, ESETI.org, by the way, ECETI.org, is having two events this summer. One is the 24th of this month, new speakers to that event, great speakers in and of themselves. I'll be there to listen to them. And then in August, in the latter part of August, we will have the Earth Transformation Conference, and I will be there presenting again this summer. I'd be happy to meet you if you want to come up there. I would implore you to go to ESETI.org and sign up for either one of those events. I can promise you that not only will you hear presentations that will change your life forever, you'll also meet friends that you'll have for life, and you more than likely will see your first UFO because the place is just hopping with them. I saw my first one about 5 years ago there, and I have not visited that location when I have not had a similar experience. I've seen UFOs every single time I've gone. I've photographed them in the daytime. So, also, those of you that are waiting for a toll-free number for Station 2, it is coming. It is coming. But most of you are going to call in by cell phone anyway. Off planet, it is 530-413-4511. East of Earth, 530-413-4515, and west of Earth, 530-413-4520. Now, I'm told that the conference line number is now 760-569-7676, and the access code is 192919, pound. So if you want to step out, you want to listen to the program, that's the number to call.
The studio in Paradise, California has now added a T1 line. So the studio has the same bandwidth as a 10-story skyscraper. And that's why the sound is so good. BBS Radio, as you know, is the number one internet talk radio network in the world. And X Squared Radio is very often the number one program on that network. We're happy to be there. It is. It has been a lot of hard work, and it's been a very rewarding experience. And you have brought us to this point, and I greatly appreciate it. Coming up, not tonight, but coming up this month, we're going to be interviewing Peter Voltaggio. Now, Peter wrote a book called Business Lessons from an Alien. I had to have the book. So we got it in from the publisher. I am in the process of reading and reviewing it. Fascinating stuff. We're going to have him on the program. He's going to be a great interview. And we're going to have some more authors on the rest of this month. But that being said, tonight there was just some just amazing news, staggering news about China selling off its holdings of U.S. treasuries. We predicted that it was going to happen. I didn't predict that it was going to be retaliatory for U.S. weapons sales. That took me by surprise. But the most fascinating thing about it was that while China was selling, the U.S., the Federal Reserve was buying. And as I said earlier, they're less federal than Federal Express. Okay, they really should be called the Nephilim Bank. They should be called the Alchemical Value for Nothing or Nothing for Value Bank. The American Change Bank, I guess we could call them. But they're not American. They are owned by foreign elitists who do not have liberty and freedom and independence as their goal. They have financial dependence, and they want to make sure that the way we drive, the way we eat, the way we live, the way we travel, the way we reproduce and consume our planet is governed by them. They are the same ones that brought you historically popular events like World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, the Spanish-American War, and they are firmly ensconced in the planning room of all of the war that's going on in the world today. They're the ones selling the weapons. They're the ones selling the fuel to both sides. And so now you know who they are, and maybe, just maybe, we can do something about it. Don't really know if we can or not, but let's get into our next segment. Tonight, we're going to talk about, with a little less scare tactic than some of my colleagues in the industry, shall we call them. We don't really do conspiracy theories here. We deal strictly in facts. We deal in the scientific viewpoint behind everything that we approach, the political science, the economic science, and now we're going to talk about genetic science. This is a subject that raises a lot of energy. It raises a lot of interest and fear, but ultimately, at the headwaters of all the money in this is you. That's right, the American consumer, the world consumer, shall I say. Those of you that are going to your grocery stores and buying things off the shelves realize that virtually everything on that shelf, with the exception of, you know, very well preserved foods in cans or whatever, all that stuff is perishable. That means it has a shelf life. All those vegetables and fruits and everything that you see on display with their bright colors and glistening droplets of moisture underneath daylight bulbs to make them look as delicious as possible, all that stuff is perishable. Now, it will last
a little bit longer than it would at your local farmer's market because, well, it's had a little help on the inside, on the outside, some things that just make it last a little bit longer. But those oranges, those bananas, those guavas, the rhubarb, everything you see on there is all perishable, which means if you don't buy it, it's going to rot. And if it's going to rot, the 30, 40, 50% profit that that market was going to make off of that food, it disappears. Yeah, it bites into the pocketbook in a big hurry. Kroger's, Walmart, Alpha Beta, Vons, they don't like to throw food away. Nope, nope, not at all. They don't like to compact that food and throw it into the landfill. Not after they've paid the farmers, which have driven their tractors and bought the seed and cultivated the land and fought off all the pests and killed all the weeds. Not after all that work. They don't want to see it get to the grocery store shelf and rot. But that's exactly what it does if you don't buy it. That's the power you have in the marketplace. So let's talk a little bit about genetically engineered food. This is a subject I cannot cover in 2 hours. I will tell you that. I have, in the few days that I've been doing the research for this program, I have 37 pages of notes here. There's no way I can cover it all. But we're going to cover the high points. And if you want, you can write me and I will send you my 37-page research. It's quite stunning, believe me. None of this is scary as far as, you know, letting you know that there's going to be mercury in your oranges or some virus sprayed on your potatoes or whatever. You're going to get that in other programs, but not here. This is what's going on now, what has gone on, how aware the American public has been, the American court system, the FDA, blah, 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 and what Congress and the Senate are doing about it now. And it's powerful stuff. Powerful stuff. We have political science. We have viral science. We have bacterial science. We have recombinant DNA woven all through this, and you're going to find it interesting. Now, the engineered foods have been largely done by the big manufacturing companies. I was going to say agricultural companies, but they aren't really. They're just factories. An issue that has entered the mainstream media in a lot of countries, noticeably not really in the U.S., and I'll explain that in a minute, is genetic engineering or genetic modification. We call it GM, genetically modified foods. A lot of food that we eat today contains genetically modified ingredients. And it usually contains it without our knowledge. Now, that's going to change, but it's changing slowly. And it's changing because of public pressure. Supporters of this technology maintain, this is the pros, that it ensures and sustains food security around the world as the population increases. As time goes on, the science behind genetic engineering is no doubt improving. Biotechnology could be the wave of the future, and genetically modified foods could really provide alternatives to help increase food production. However, there is a wave of concern that's growing from citizens, farmers, and also scientists who question the way the research is currently being handled by a few large profit-hungry corporations. That is, as well as scientific debates on the merits of genetically engineered food. Now, let's not debate the morality of messing with Mother Nature. We won't bother with the morality of taking genes from a jellyfish and sticking it in a cabbage, or genes from a peanut and sticking it into celery. We won't mess with that because that's a whole other debate.
The problem of food shortages is a political and economic problem. And food shortages and hunger are and will be experienced by, well, not us, not developed nations, but the poorer nations, okay? The poorer nations. And now you want to put your finger against your temple right about now and rub it and say, wait a minute. You mean this multi-billion dollar research of recombinant DNA and messing with the genome of nature to fight off pestilence and work in low water environments and resist disease and viruses is for the poorer nations? Yes. Genetically engineered food is an expensive technology that the farmers of the developing nations would not be able to afford easily. This is true. This is true. And neither would the consumers. Somebody has to pay for that. That's right. The patenting laws go against the poor around the world and allow biotech companies to benefit from patenting indigenous knowledge, often without consent. Now, how do they turn this into profit? Great question. I'm going to cover that in great detail. But first, I don't want to misrepresent the big companies. Namely, I'm going to talk about Monsanto. I want them to represent themselves. And so I'm going to play for you Monsanto's own video from their own website. Here we go. Listen closely.
When you close your eyes and visualize our planet, what do you see? An orb hanging in the blackness of space? A hand-drawn map elegantly defining the line between land and sea? Now, go outside and stand barefoot in the grass. Look around. Breathe the air. Feel the planet move beneath you. What you're feeling is a living planet. What you're feeling is our home. But the planet feels us too. It feels the increasing weight of us and the stress of supporting that weight. You may not realize that because home may look fine where you're standing now. But stand in the congested streets of a developing country and you'll see millions of people struggling to feed themselves. Stand in the Amazon or the Arctic and you'll see ancient rainforests and majestic shelves of ice disappearing. And stand in one of the many isolated villages around the world and you'll see farmers with little access to technology or markets unable to pull themselves out of poverty. These global challenges are complex, and there are no easy answers. But one thing is clear. Agricultural innovation holds a key solution, and we pledge to do our part. We're Monsanto, and we're working with farmers and partners worldwide to realize a vision for sustainable agriculture. It's a vision that strives to meet the needs of a rapidly growing population, to protect and preserve this planet we all call home, and to help improve lives everywhere. We're working with farmers to increase what they can grow on an acre of land, and we're making great progress. We're working to reduce the amount of land, water, and energy they'll need to grow those crops. And we're working to improve lives in the process by harnessing innovative technology to give growers better tools so they can provide for their families, their communities, and people around the world. Because when farmers prosper, so many more will also prosper. Through healthier diets, greater educational opportunities, and brighter economic futures. Agriculture has always had a role in shaping the future of humanity. And we know it will take more than one company to shape the future of agriculture. So whatever the world looks like where you stand, the truth is, we're all in this together. And we believe, working together, we can create a brighter, sustainable world for all of us. That's the world we visualize at Monsanto, and we're working every day to make it reality.
Okay, that's Monsanto's own promotional video off their own website. Okay, no misrepresentation there. But you understand that Monsanto is selling you on the social politics of helping developing countries eat. And yet, these developing countries, by their own admission, cannot afford the technology that's being spent to create these crops. Here's the important thing. This is a very young and untested technology, and it may not be the answer just yet. Crop uniformity, which the biotech firms are promoting, will reduce genetic diversity, making them more vulnerable to disease and pests. This furthers the need for pesticides, often created by the same companies creating and promoting genetically engineered crops. Hence, this leads to questions of the motives of the corporations and the countries who are using the plight of the developing world as a marketing strategy to gain acceptance of genetically engineered food, as well as dependency upon it via intellectual property rights. I'm going to explain that intellectual property rights here in just a second. That they are against any labeling or other precautionary steps and measures that states may wish to take this of paramount concern. The way in which we reach the answer to the question, are genetically engineered foods safe, is where a lot of the problem lies. Now, if you're creating a crop that you want to be paid for, and you want to get paid very good money for it, because it takes a lot of money to do all of this genetic research. There's a lot of trial and error. There's also a lot of collateral damage. In other words, you create some abominations. Now, admittedly, the abomination is a corn plant that's orange, or it's a grape, you know, that is got nodules all over it, looks like a blackberry. Admittedly, the abominations are plants, and they can't scream out in agony as would, say, a cow with six legs or two heads or three-eyed fish. But nevertheless, it takes a lot of trial and error. It takes a lot of money to get this to go, and, well, developing countries aren't going to be able to pay for that. Who pays for that? Well, the farmer pays for it. The farmer buys the seed, but what happens if the farmer doesn't buy the seed? This is where the intellectual property argument comes in. We're going to play a couple of clips tonight for you to show off this tactic that is being used, and it is being used, and it is happening right before our very eyes. This is this is how the intellectual property is manipulated in and around the economy where large-scale farming is taking place. And, it's nefarious, I'm going to say that, where you have one field that is, say, ungenetically modified corn being grown, and the field next to you, you have genetically modified corn growing. Well, let's just talk about the intellectual property rights here, and then we'll talk about some of the side effects that have happened and have been near misses in our current economy using genetically modified foods. What happens is when these plants begin to grow, of course, they begin to flower. They have to flower in order to create the seed, in order to create the fruit of the vine, right? The fruit of the corn. So when they flower, these things have to be fertilized, they have to be pollinated. And they're usually pollinated by the wind, or they're pollinated by insects that fly from one plant to the other, and the plants cross-pollinate. So what happens is the fruit, that is to say the corn kernel that is created, is the product of the fertilization process. The female plant and the male part of the plant coming together to make the seed, to make the corn. Now, what happens is Monsanto plants a field of their genetically modified corn next to a field of not genetically modified corn. One pollinates the other, and sure enough, the seed is the result of this cross-pollination. Well, the interesting thing is that
Monsanto samples the corn of the field that doesn't have the genetically modified seed in it that grew the corn, and lo and behold, there is their genetic marker in the corn, in the ear of the corn that's growing on the plant. So then they file an infringement suit against the farmer to collect the royalties on the patent, because you see, that genetically modified marker, that genetically modified food, is actually patented and is owned by Monsanto. And so Monsanto then elicits royalties from the farmer for the intellectual property, which is now growing in that farmer's field. And this is working. It is working, because this is how it functions. Now, this is an actual interview that's being done of farmers in the field. They have been in court, and they have defended themselves against this tactic. Here we go. Monsanto budgets $10 million each year to investigate and sue farmers who are not paying.
We stood up to Monsanto, and it went to trial. It ended up in the Supreme Court of Canada, where everything they came after me, they lost. They lost the case, but the Supreme Court ruled that Monsanto's patent on a gene is valid. It doesn't matter how it ends up in any life form, they own and control it. And that was a startling decision, is that even if you have your crop, organic farmer or conventional farmer, and your crop is contaminated, the amount of contamination doesn't matter. They own your seeds and plants, and if you use them, you're liable to a lawsuit under patent law. So that's what the case is all about, and that shows how Monsanto can get control over the seed supply and food supply through cross-pollination, direct seed movement, blowing in the wind or whatever. It doesn't matter how it gets there, the court's ruled. You don't own your seeds or plants anymore. So it would give them, the corporations now, total control over the seed supply, ultimately the food supply.
Okay, the future of farming can be seen in Iraq, where the U.S., quote, liberated farmers by requiring that they only plant certified seeds from companies like Monsanto. You'll remember one of the largest seed banks in the world was in Iraq. Iraq is the seed of all agriculture in the world, going back thousands of years, is in Iraq. One of the first casualties of the Iraq War in 1991, you got it, the seed bank. Here we go. The destruction of the Iraqi seed banks represents an assault on all people and the future of sustainable agriculture.
When the U.S. began its occupation of Iraq back in 2003.
By the way, this is Brian Tokar. He's from the Institute for Social Ecology, and he's the author.
One of the stated goals on the part of a lot of policy people behind the scenes was to turn Iraq into a model for the next generation of neoliberal economic policies, to impose a level of forced privatization and corporate dominance over every area of life that goes far beyond anything we've seen really anywhere in the world. There were 100 special orders that were imposed by Paul Bremer when he was the administrator of Iraq under the first stages of the occupation, that were established in a way that they could not be overturned by any future Iraqi constitution. Order 81 had to do with control over seeds, and it made it illegal for Iraqi farmers to plant seeds that are not certified by some international authority. Now, Iraq is where wheat cultivation was first developed. It's really the cradle of human civilization. It's where agriculture was first developed, where people learned to cultivate seeds and till the land and improve crop varieties over time. So there are probably thousands of traditional seed varieties, particularly wheat varieties, that are unique to that part of the world that are no longer legal for Iraqi farmers to grow.
We shouldn't unleash this massive...
This is Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. He's an author and a biologist. He's analyzing this from a scientific point of view, from a biologist point of view, not a politician. What went on?
Experiment on huge numbers of farmers and consumers throughout the world in the absence of knowing what it's going to do. If it were a matter of life and death and survival, the risk might be worth it. But it's not a matter of life and death and survival. It may be a matter of life and death and survival for Monsanto and a few other chemical companies, but for most of us it isn't. We can eat perfectly good food without having it genetically modified. And these companies promise that in Africa and other parts of the third world, they'll be able to solve the problems of starvation and hunger by means of these crops. Well, if they could actually do that, rather than claim that they might be able to do it in the future, there'd probably be less argument about it. But the fact is that at the moment, this is simply a propaganda point that they make to try and justify the technology, claiming to be caring about poor people. Actually, they've put almost no effort into caring about poor people. Their whole effort has been put into getting richer themselves. So I see no reason why we should have an experiment inflicted upon us by companies whose only aim is profit on this massive scale. It's not worth taking any risks at all on a massive scale if there's no benefit associated with them. The calculus of risk and benefit in this case comes down in favor of avoiding the risks and sticking with what we know and trust, namely regular plants produced by regular plant breeding.
For over 100 years, Monsanto has produced some of the most toxic chemicals ever made. I'm just going to give you a short list here. Herbicides, pesticides, dioxins, DDT, RBGH, PCBs, aspartame, and Agent Orange. DDT was widely known to be harmful to wildlife and humans in the 50s, but it wasn't banned until 1972 due to pressure. In Anniston, Alabama, a Monsanto plant dumped millions of pounds of PCBs into leaking aquifers. Monsanto hid their knowledge from the people of Anniston, and tens of thousands of Americans were poisoned. Morticians wondered why they were burying so many children. Monsanto sold a defoliant called Agent Orange to the U.S. military. I don't even need to tell you the levels of dioxin that are still in the soil there. 400,000 Vietnamese children were later born with deformities. Aspartame is an artificial sweetener found in most low-calorie and diet foods. I call it Asper Death. It's associated with brain cancer, hair loss, asthma, seizures, weight gain, and death. Wait a minute, weight gain? I thought we were drinking a diet drink. A government report in India showed that Monsanto's genetically engineered cotton produced a net income that was five times less than non-genetically engineered cotton. That's just staggering to me that the economics are not there to go along with it. Over 400 farmers committed suicide as a result. They went broke. They couldn't feed their families. Over 17,000 children, some as young as six, support Monsanto's subsidiary in India by working in dangerous chemical plants. Genetically engineered crops make it possible to spray more of the herbicide, glyphosate. Well, a lot of this is text, so I'm going to bypass that because I have this already in my notes and I want to cover it with you. And by the way, Obama appointed
Monsanto officials as to head up the FDA. So there's so much happening here with genetically engineered foods that we're talking about genetically engineered crops. And when we talk about this, we want to talk about, what's going on? Why are these things being created? The case is that we need economically sustainable mega farms in order to be able to feed the world, because the world is starving. And so what they do is they genetically engineer these foods, and I'm going to go into generally what's been done to genetically modify the foods. Things that don't normally occur in nature are being toyed with, different qualities being toyed with in order to put this together. But there is unintended harm to other organisms. There are environmental hazards. There are ecological hazards. Last year, a laboratory study was published in Nature magazine showing that pollen from BT corn, which is a genetically engineered corn that Monsanto makes, caused high mortality rates in monarch butterfly caterpillars. Well, that's kind of strange, because monarch butterfly caterpillars, they don't live off of corn. They live off of milkweed. They consume milkweed parts, not corn. But the fear is that if pollen from BT corn is blown by the wind onto milkweed plants in neighboring fields, the caterpillars would eat the pollen and perish. Although the Nature study was not conducted under natural field conditions, the results seem to support this viewpoint. Unfortunately, BT toxins kill many species of insect larvae indiscriminately. That's what it's designed to do, to make the corn resistant to insects. It is not possible to design a BT toxin that would only kill crop-damaging pests and remain harmless to other insects. Keep in mind that bees are also insects. We have seen many, many articles talking about the fact that bees have been disappearing from our fields. You know, there are beekeepers that each year drive their trucks and their hives across the Midwest, set them up so that the bees can pollinate the plants. Many of these plants are genetically modified, and they have these BT toxins in them. And the bees, living off the nectar and moving pollen from one plant to another, are being wiped out by the toxins that are in the pollen. Now, this study is being re-examined by the USDA, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and other non-government research groups, and preliminary data from new studies suggests that the original study may have been flawed. This topic is the subject of an acrimonious debate on both sides, which resulted in lawsuits being filed and the production of genetically modified corn to be delayed for a couple of years. Now, it's interesting to note that this BT corn wasn't really a popular seller, and so thus wasn't really planted in a lot of fields. And so thus, just by luck, the monarch butterfly was not wiped out. But had it been a popular seller, the monarch butterfly caterpillar might have been wiped out. The other impact that you have is you have a gene transfer to non-target species. That's right. In other words, genetic material is moved from one organism to another organism by consumption. Okay? So, hang on a second. I got a text. I'm going to bring the new seed. Oh, yeah. We're going to bring that up. I promise. Last hour, we're going to talk about the seed banks and where they are, who has them left, and what happened to the ones we already had. Another concern is that crop plants engineered for herbicide tolerance and weeds will crossbreed, resulting in the transfer of the herbicide-resistant genes from the crops into, you got it, the weeds, the very weeds that we're trying to get rid of. These super weeds would then be herbicide tolerant as well. Other introduced genes may cross over into non-modified crops planted next to genetically modified crops. The possibility of interbreeding is shown by the defense of farmers against lawsuits filed by Monsanto. And Monsanto is spending better than $10 million a year in court with lawyers suing farmers over patent infringements. And it's not just in this country. As you heard in the piece earlier, that was a farmer that had some very large fields in Canada. The company has filed patent infringement lawsuits against farmers who may have harvested genetically modified crops. Monsanto claims that the farmers obtained Monsanto-licensed genetically modified seeds from an unknown source and did not pay royalties to Monsanto. The farmers claim that their unmodified crops were cross-pollinated from someone else's genetically modified crops planted a field or two away. And, of course, nobody puts it past Monsanto sales reps driving by with a palm full of seeds, tossing them over into the field as the regular fields are being sown. There are several possible solutions to the three problems mentioned above. Now, I want you to pay close attention to these because it opens a whole nother can of genetic worms. Genes are exchanged between plants via pollen. Two ways to ensure that non-target species will not receive introduced genes from genetically modified plants are to create genetically modified plants that are male sterile, that is to say they don't produce pollen, or to modify the genetically modified plant so that the pollen does not contain the introduced gene. In other words, even if it does pollinate, it doesn't contain the introduced gene. Well, that's not going to fly. Where is the economic value in that? Cross-pollination would not occur. And if harmless insects such as monarch caterpillars were to eat pollen from genetically modified plants, the caterpillars would survive. Sounds like a good plan, but there's a lot of collateral damage when it comes to genetically modifying these foods. Sometimes they go in and actually manipulate the genetic material on a molecular level. That's very expensive and also does not have a big yield. Normally, the way this is done is with viruses. Viruses form molecular macrophages. Now, a macrophage, think of it like a little lunar lander. Inside the little lunar lander, which is a little molecular casing, inside of that is the genetic material. Now, the lunar lander has a big injection needle on it. It links up with the cell, it pierces the cell wall, and it injects into the cell the genetic material, which now mixes with the genetic material in that cell during the time of reproduction, and you now have genetic mutation. Very, very handy, but also very indiscriminate. Okay, what can happen is we have human health risks. Allergies. Many children in the U.S. and Europe have developed life-threatening allergies to peanuts and other foods. There is a possibility that introducing a gene into a plant may create a new allergen or cause an allergic reaction in susceptible individuals. A proposal to incorporate a gene from Brazil nuts into soybeans was abandoned because of the fear of causing unexpected allergic reactions. For now, extensive testing
of genetically modified foods may be required to avoid the possibility of harm to consumers with food allergies. And of course, labeling of genetically modified foods and food products will acquire new importance. And that's going to come at an increased cost on all kinds of levels. It's going to cause excess cost on the governmental level because now you have to create a new agency with new scientists and new equipment and new budgets to be able to monitor this. It's going to require the development of labeling policy. It's going to require guidelines for these research companies to follow. And keep in mind that these guidelines will only apply inside the country that actually passes these regulations. Outside the country, in the developing countries, those laws won't apply. Now, there's a growing concern that introducing foreign genes into food plants may have an unexpected and negative impact on human health. I can almost guarantee it. I can almost guarantee it. It's pretty safe to say that the food that exists on the planet right now has been eaten and digested, and either we develop an allergy to it or we don't, for tens of thousands of years. When you suddenly accelerate or change tracks on the natural selection of plants to survive by artificially moving genes between species, then you're introducing a whole new set of effects. Because after all, we are what we eat. We are the organic material. The peas and carrots that make up the human body are made of the organic material that is made by plants as it takes the nutrients from the ground, sunlight, water, and carbon dioxide, and makes the sugars and the proteins that we consume. When you change that, you're now changing everything downstream from that. The cattle that eat the grass, the people that eat the cattle, you change everything downstream in the food source. Now, that can be a good thing, but most often it's going to be a bad thing because you have to continue to do the research. A recent article published in Lancet examined the effects of genetically modified potatoes now on the digestive tract in rats. This study claimed that there were appreciable differences in the intestines of rats fed genetically modified potatoes and rats fed unmodified potatoes. Yet critics say that this paper, like the monarch butterfly data, is flawed and does not hold up to scientific scrutiny. Moreover, the gene introduced to the potatoes was a snowdrop flower lectin, a substance known to be toxic to mammals. Rats are mammals. Humans are mammals. The scientists who created this variety of potato chose to use the lectin gene simply to test the methodology. And these potatoes were never intended for human or animal consumption. On the whole, with the exception of possible allergies, scientists believe that genetically modified foods do not present a human health risk. Well, that's highly interesting because there are cases in which this does have an effect on the animals that eat these crops. Current FDA policy was developed in 1992. Gee, that's pretty recent. Federal Register docket number 92N0139 and states that agribiotech companies may voluntarily ask the FDA for a consultation. Voluntarily. Got it. Sounds safe to me. Companies working to create new genetically modified foods are not required to consult the FDA, nor are they required to follow the FDA's recommendations after the consultation. Consumer interest groups wish this process to be mandatory so that all genetically modified food products, Whole Foods or otherwise, must be approved by the FDA before being released for commercialization. The FDA counters that the agency currently does not have the time, money, or resources to carry out exhaustive health and safety studies of every proposed genetically modified food product. But I'm sure they'd be willing to accept money from companies like Monsanto in order to be able to do that. Secondly, what are the acceptable limits of genetically modified contamination in non-genetically modified products? The economic community has determined that 1% is an acceptable limit of cross-contamination. Yet many consumer interest groups argue that only 0% is acceptable. Some companies such as Gerber Baby Foods and Frito-Lay, you know Frito-Lay, don't you? The owners of Pizza Hut, the owners of Pepsi, and the owners of Taco Bell, have pledged to avoid use of genetically modified foods in any of their products. But who is going to monitor these companies for compliance? And what is the penalty if they fail? Once again, the FDA does not have the resources to carry out testing to ensure compliance. By the way, just so you know, the grilled burrito for Taco Bell, you got it. Genetically modified corn. What is the level of detectability of a genetically modified food cross-contamination? Well, it's quite expensive to conduct. A 1% threshold may already be below current levels of detectability. In other words, it has to get to 2 or 3 or 4 or 5% before it can even be detected using most methods, which means that 0% is acceptable but not enforceable. A 1% cross-contamination may already be taking place, and we cannot detect it. So in January of 2000, an international trade agreement for labeling GM foods was established. More than 130 countries, including the U.S., the world's largest producer of GM foods, signed the agreement. The policy states that exporters must be required to label all GM foods and that importing countries have the right to judge for themselves the potential risk and reject GM foods if they so choose. By the way, genetically modified rice has already been rejected almost worldwide. The only business Monsanto Company is involved in is agriculture. That is why Monsanto invests both time and money in research to help create the best seed possible for farmers. Well, describe best. Whether it's through breeding or biotechnology, Monsanto is committed to research in various agricultural crops. Now, breeding is one thing, because a plant that's going to breed is going to breed. Introducing sexual partners to one another is, well, at the heart of all biodiversity on the planet. But through biotechnology, you're taking plants or species that would never have met. They would never hooked up. Even in the most inebriated conditions would they have hooked up and had something like what has been produced occur. Before we go any further, let's go ahead and take a call. Diane on line one, welcome to the program.
Hi, Brooks. How are you tonight?
I'm doing wonderful. Voice is getting a little tired, but
I guess, yeah, I love the topics tonight. I just wanted to bring something to your attention. Are you familiar with the Institute for Responsible Technology?
No, but I want to be. Fill me in.
Okay. This has to do with the GMO, the subject you're talking about at this point. Jeffrey Smith, who has done years of research in the GMO around the world, according to Jeffrey Smith, right now in the United States, as of May of 2010, genetically modified crops in this country are 91% of all soy, 71% of all cotton, 88% of all canola, and 85% of all corn, with the exception of blue corn or white corn. Sugar beets are at 90%, 50% on Hawaiian papaya, and then they've also are testing, which there's no percentage on, is alfalfa, zucchini, and yellow squash, as well as tobacco, being the Quest brand.
Wow. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court had a hearing, biotech crops like Roundup Ready alfalfa, which you just mentioned. They do bring immense benefits to growers, the environment, and consumers around the world, and that's why Monsanto filed several appeals when January 15th of last year, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, because this whole thing was put on hold for about a year and a half, and Monsanto had, you know, a couple of billion dollars tied up in this. And the case was remanded to lower court, and it went back and forth, and finally the Supreme Court ruled the expert agency, APHIS, in this case, has the authority to make regulatory decisions while it is completing the broader study. Now, the interesting thing about that is that they, just as you said, let the introduction of these crops continue. And the corn, which, by the way, the maize corn has been almost completely rejected by the market, even though it has been grown. It hasn't been bought. So the word is out, and lots of people are aware of this, and they're using their dollars to make these decisions. But Monsanto,
my understanding is, Brooks, is that anything that is not actually, that people do not understand in the processing of these products, such as let's go to like soy. You've got soy protein, soy isolates. You've got soy lecithin. You've got vegetable proteins, that and soy flour. Those are all genetically modified. When it comes to corn, it is corn flour, corn mesa, corn starch, corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup, which is extremely has negative benefits. Negative effects on the human body, especially children. With high fructose corn syrup.
About if you want to grow your own garden, say you go to the local grocery store and you buy a seed off the rack and you plant that in your garden, are those genetically modified seeds as well?
Many of them are, because burpee and some of the ones, from my understanding, and I could be wrong on this, they are, because Monsanto has bought those seed companies up. Now, if you go with heritage seeds, or you go with organic seeds, absolutely not.
Interesting.
But if you go with the seeds that are, with the exception of in the corn area, the white corn or the blue corn have not yet genetically modified, from my understanding.
Interesting. I know that
I would highly recommend for you in this subject, because there's several DVDs out by Jeffrey Smith at the Institute for Responsible Technology. All right, to have him on your program, because he is extremely knowledgeable. He's been doing this for years. In fact, he's a one-man army, quite frankly.
Well, I mean, the main thing is to keep people aware of what's going on. There can be a lot of, you know, unwarranted fear over some of this stuff. The point is that there is a lot of collateral damage when you're doing genetic manipulation. And if enough research is done on, you know, what the effects are, what changes are actually being made to the organism, and is this something that would naturally have taken place, you know, through normal, I'm not going to call it evolution, I'll call it natural selection, or is this something like you're taking a jellyfish gene and sticking it into cabbage, or you're taking the Brazil nut and sticking it into peanuts? That's something that would never, ever occur in nature.
Well, my understanding is the fact that, especially in soy, because there's almost no food processed that you can buy without a soy product in it. And even canola, of course, is something that is a weed that was grown, and it got its name from Canada, because it was grown in Canada. None of the wild animals will touch it because it's very highly toxic. And we have genetically modified at this point, or at 2010, 88% of this. When you go into the farmers and you take a look at those farmers who have been feeding their cows and their pigs corn, because corn, I'm not know if you're aware of this, but corn has no nutritional value or very little nutritional value. But what it does do is it puts on a lot of weight. And so the last couple of weeks of the life of the calf or the sow in which they're going to take to market before they're slaughtered, they feed it corn. And even in the process of feeding it corn while it is lactating or so forth, the animals that are being birthed from as a result of feeding the genetically modified food, grains and so forth, has been deformity, and it's incredible. There's incredible DVDs out there that show this, and as they're actually interviewing farmers across the United States. And my understanding, in India, there has been many, because of religion as well, them confiscating the seeds in Iraq, but they have committed suicide because they have lost their entire crops as a result of genetically modified.
Right, right. We mentioned that about half an hour ago. But the main thing to realize, too, here is that this virulent E. coli, which ends up in hamburger and makes people sick, and we've seen it also in Germany, some 1,800 cases just in the last few days.
If that's actual, if you know anything about it. I know I've studied E. coli, and I don't see it in any vegetables. It has, unless you absolutely put human feces on it, E. coli doesn't exist on vegetables.
Well, the virulent E. coli comes from corn feeding the beef. And if you take the cattle off of the corn and put them back on grass for 3 weeks before they're slaughtered, the virulent E. coli goes away.
Absolutely.
Grass-fed.
All cattle should be grass-fed to begin with. I had done this when I was raising my chickens and I was looking for feed. And I went to a farmer and I asked him, what was in his feed when he told me the corn. And I said, and at the time I asked him, does he sell his beef on the hook? And he said, yes, he did. And I asked him if he fed him corn. And he said, yes, he did. And I said, why do you feed him corn? Is it genetically modified? He said, oh, yes, it is. He said, if he didn't feed it corn, he couldn't get the money at the market because it wouldn't have, if it was grass fed, it would not have gained as much weight.
Exactly. Exactly. And it was corn fed beef as a sales tactic as well.
Well, a sales tactic, but also the fact that it puts on weight. But now when you take a look at it and take a look at 85% of the corn as of May of 2010 is genetically modified. This is not to feed the world. The United States right now, and you've flown over the United States many times, and you have driven through the United States, and you can see with your own eyes the vacant farmland where they have pushed farmers off their land, and they don't even farm it at all anymore. That the United States itself, with the climates that we have, we could feed the world alone.
Yes, we could. And when CRP was introduced in the 80s, wheat growing dropped to a point where at least they could control the price of wheat. Now, they haven't got genetically engineered wheat out there yet, but they're working on it.
Oh, they absolutely are working on it.
Yeah, they're working on it.
But thank you anyways. I just wanted to bring that to your attention to let you know that I misunderstood, but I thought you had said earlier that the corn had not been genetically modified. They tried it, but it didn't work, but that's not true.
No.
You go to the roadside stand and you get corn on the cob, and you get the peaches and cream, which is the white and the yellow, and of course they don't sell the blue corn, but blue corn chips, or just plain white corn. But when you get into the yellow corn, you've got to be careful.
Yeah, I understand that the corn has been heavily genetically modified, and this whole BT marker that's out there to make them resistant to insects. The interesting thing about insects is that they're very prolific, and they will figure out how to survive.
And if the BT marker is killing off the insect larva, some of the larva is going to survive. And then you're going to end up with a super insect that nothing can kill. And it's going to wipe out the world's food supply. And that's what we're going to...
The same thing with the Roundup Ready as far as the weeds. The weeds are coming back bigger and stronger and ferocious and taking over whole crops.
That's right. That's right. They're called super weeds.
That's right. Anyways, so, Brooks, thank you so much for your program tonight, but I would highly suggest that you get Jeffrey Smith on because he is just an astounding, incredible knowledge that he has in this area.
Well, I really appreciate it, Diane. Thanks so much for the call. I will check that out. Institute for Responsible Technology,
exactly.
Jeffrey Smith. Got it.
Have a thank great you. Evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Before we end this hour, let's go ahead and get Steve from Columbus, Georgia on line two. Welcome to the program.
Say, Brooks, this is a wonderful, very, very relevant subject that you're dealing with tonight. I appreciate you choosing it. I was listening to Dr. Lynn Horowitz a few nights ago on Coast to Coast, who made the observation that this aggressive E. coli that is inflicting Europe right now actually had its origin in Africa. Its first case was in Africa, and then it jumped to Germany. Now, you're not supposed to be able to do that. You know, that's not the normal endemic process. Now, an interesting observation he made about this E. coli is the effect that it has physiologically on the GI tract is that of liquefaction. It just liquefies the intestines and the stomach, and by releasing the toxins from the decaying tissue, that's poisoning the kidneys, of course, and just putting lives in danger. People are going on dialysis, and if they're not outright dying. Now, there's one virus that came out of Africa that has this quality of liquefaction, and that's the Ebola virus. Now, Ebola is normally spread by respiratory contact. It's an airborne virus. But if it's been put into the E. coli, and then the E. coli, has the macrophage infection in it, then the E. coli could be bundles of this Ebola virus, which would be doing the same job. Now, my understanding is that he has requested tissue and samples of this stuff to be sent to him, that he can break it down if the European scientists aren't already on this, because they're not too fond of genetic modified food either. I understand Europe has pretty much turned away everything GMO, just nation by nation. They're just refusing it altogether. Furthermore, this E. coli would just about have to have been sprayed directly onto the crops, you know, and this is a very nefarious deed, you know, and I certainly would hope that they would trace it down and find the origin, number one, of this E. coli, if indeed it's carrying the Ebola, and it sure looks like it is, and prosecute some people. Now, we know that the FDA, of course, as you already pointed out, the Fraud and Death Administration is mostly staffed from people from Monsanto or from Big Pharmacy, and the tests that they do are mostly funded by Monsanto and by Big Pharmacy and the people who request that certain new chemicals and new GMO substances be tested. You know, they're paying for the tests, and they're getting a lot of money for those tests. So that's a big money train going on for the people that run the FDA. You know, they want to keep that money train going, so they're going to find favorable outcomes for Monsanto and the big pharmacy people because they don't want to dry up that money train. You know, there's a lot going on right now.
That's true.
Fatten a lot of people's purses that are going to cost a lot of human lives.
And I played the video from Monsanto's website, so you could see that they're marketing this as a feed the world, you know, poor developing nations, make sure that they can make a profit and on and on and on. But it's the highly developed, highly profitable countries like the U.S. and Germany and others that are actually paying the bill.
Oh, yes. And they also dropped the message on there that the planet is heavy and can barely bear the weight of all the people and all the civilization on it. You know, and that's planting a message, too, that the problem facing the planet right now is the presence of people. So here they are generating all this frankenfood and so on that's absolutely no good to human beings or to livestock or to anybody else. And it just stinks of eugenics. It just stinks of eugenics. Another thing that they're doing with a lot of this corn that they're pushing onto the third world countries is they're taking antibodies from women who have immune response infertility. You know, they reject their fetuses about the second trimester. Good. You know, they spontaneously abort. Uh-huh. And they put this stuff into the corn that they're selling, that they're pushing into these third world countries. And as the women consume the corn and the corn products, now they're having spontaneous abortions, you know, and it's depleting the population in these third world countries. It's keeping them from developing. This is all population control and targeted against the human race. You know, these people hate the human race. You know, they want to make money now and in the process get rid of as many of us as they can. And it's so transparent, Brooks. It's just so transparent. It just blows my mind that more people can't see this, and something isn't done to stop it, you know. But the powers that be seem to be just hell bent on
things. You know, because once these crops are out there and they're growing, then what you have is you have the source of destruction of all of the food on the planet.
Right.
And so, you know, you're controlling the world's food supply, but you can't stop it. Once these plants are out there and growing, you can't just turn them off. They take over
the planet. That's a fact. That's a fact, because the cross-pollination process, Brooks, that you've already touched on, totally contaminates and wrecks the heirloom plants, the original plants that are native to an area. You know, they're ruined once they're contaminated by these GMO substances. You know, you can't grow the old stuff anymore. You know, you just can't do it. And furthermore, the GMO crops, if you've ever tried to save seed from a GMO crop and replant it, it doesn't work. You know, you don't get stalks of corn full of fat ears, you know. You just don't. You're lucky to get anything out of it, you know. So you have to keep buying the seed over and over again from the same source, and it doesn't work to save seed crop anymore.
Well, there is some alarm. There has been some alarm raised, and some private investors have put together what is called the Doomsday Vault. Kind of interesting. On a remote mountainside of the Norwegian tundra sits the Doomsday Vault, a backup against disaster. And
know who owns that? You know who has access to that? The same people that are pushing Monsanto. The same people that are pushing the New World Order on us. You know,
it's actually the Global Crop Diversity Trust. Now, I wanted to find out who was part of this. They're partners with the Norwegian government and the Nordic Genetic Resource Center in Sweden. And I wanted to find out who is the Crop Diversity Trust. I have names. Egypt.
I'll tell you, Brooks, if it has the name genetic in it, they just about have to be into eugenics. One of the most important courses, a very basic course, for anybody who majors in eugenics or let's say genetic engineering, genetic biology. I have a brother-in-law with a PhD in genetics who was part of the team that developed the vaccine against Lyme disease. And some of the most basic foundational courses that they drum into the people's minds is eugenics, is manipulating manipulating genes for population control purposes. You know, those are their foundational texts.
The fittest. But here are the members of the Crop Diversity Trust. These are the signers. Egypt, Cape Verde, Jordan, Togo, Morocco, Syria, Samoa, Ethiopia, Tonga, Peru, Mali, Ecuador, Colombia, Sweden, Mauritius, Serbia and Montenegro, Cameroon, Cambodia, Pakistan, Romania, Uganda, Kenya, Australia, Ghana, India, and Switzerland. Notably absent are all the European countries, Canada, Mexico, and the United States.
Yeah, one of the first names that jumped out at me there was Egypt. Egypt is where our cotton crop went. I know I'm calling from the South. The South is where cotton used to be grown, and it was the home of the textile industry. And there were cotton mills and textile mills everywhere. They went to Egypt and took John Deere with them. John Deere went to Egypt, and the textile mills went to Egypt, and cotton went to Egypt. And I can't imagine that they're not using GMO. If they are, my hat's off to them.
The wheat came from Egypt. In fact, the wheat that is 2,000 years old that the people are now growing in Washington State that came from the vaults of Egypt is about five times the size and more nutritive value than the wheat that we currently grow, the hard red winter wheat in the United States.
Well, good.
It's wheat. But
Egypt's main grain actually wasn't wheat, though. It was spelt, this stuff called spelt, which you can still get out there. It's not easy to get hold of, but you can still get spelt. But if that's the case, if they're growing some good non-GMO wheat here and there, you know, if there's a glimmer of hope, then I'm excited by it. But
wheat's really the breadbasket of the world. Wheat and rice are the two grains that actually feed the world. And so far, they haven't messed with it. Now, I understand that the Doomsday Vault has more original, virgin, non-genetically engineered seed than any other place on the planet. Now, it used to be we had a big vault like this in Iraq. But as you heard in the very first part of the program, Order 81, the first 100 orders that were carried out by Bremer was to take that seed bank apart. It was destroyed in the first years of the war.
I wonder where the seed went. I wonder if the seed went down into those tunnels, the tunnels in Colorado or someplace.
Well, if you've seen the video of this Doomsday Vault, it is really something spectacular. I've got a little audio that I want to play as soon as our phone call is over. But it appears that this report by EcoNexus, which is it's based on peer-reviewed scientific literature in the USDA, it examines the consequences of genetic modification events for the integrity of this transgenic plant genomes. And they've come up with some very, very alarming stuff. It's not necessarily the genetic modifications that are the most dangerous, although they are. It's the mutations that scatter during subsequent generations as the plant finds its kind of, you know, level place. It becomes its own organism. It becomes uncontrollable.
Right. We know, as a registered nurse, I am an RN down here, and I work in a major hospital here in town. It's hard to be a purveyor of the mill, you know, that keeps people fed into big pharmacy and GMO food and so on. My biggest patient teaching spiels that I give is trying to pull cardiac patients away from eating high fructose corn syrup and aspartame and rattling off some of the foods that these people would never suspect are contaminated with this stuff, and tell them, look, you can avoid statins if you'll just quit the high fructose corn syrup. You know, and you can think clearer and stay off the doggone medicine for Parkinson's or for Alzheimer's if you'll just leave aspartame alone. You know, and they have a hard time believing that aspartame was part of the Army's inventory of chemical warfare until they figured out that it could trick the tongue into thinking there's something sweet on it, and then they pushed it on all of us. It's an ongoing process. So I appreciate you having this show on, and I'm going to go ahead and let you go. Brooks, thank you for entertaining my call, and I can't wait to hear what you're about to play. I know it's going to be very enlightening.
Thank you so much, Steve, for the call. Great, great information. You can call back anytime. Well, what we have here, we have a couple pieces because we have about 25 minutes left in the program. The one thing I want to play for you, I'm going to play an interview that was done describing what the Doomsday Vault is. Now, this is an NBC News correspondent that went to the vault, went through it, and you'll hear basically what the qualities of this vault are. There are a couple things that alarm me about it. One is that it's so remote and inaccessible to the rest of the world, and the other is who's in control of it. But listen to the qualities of this thing.
In the mountain, and even the worst case climate change scenario, it's going to be freezing back here 200 years from now.
400 feet underground, the bunker is a last-ditch reserve, ready to replenish the world's farmers if all else fails.
It's really a history of our own life on planet Earth, and it's also a future resource for us, for our children.
Seeds are coming from all over the globe, representing every known variety of crop. Expert seed hunters like Ken Street search far-flung places here to Tajikistan for ancient varieties before they disappear.
Yes, girl.
Fantastic.
It's believed one variety of plant becomes extinct every day, wiped out by disease, natural disaster, human conflict, or climate change.
And without this genetic diversity to draw from,
this is Ken Street.
It's just gone.
We're not only deep inside a mountain here. This place is protected by heavy steel doors, three airlocks, and a sophisticated video surveillance system. And in case that isn't enough, outside, polar bears.
Now, this is in Svalbard, which is an island in the archipelago. It's above a fjord. It's above the level of any sea that might rise due to climate change, and these seeds should be safe. By the way, they have polar bears outside to guard it, so don't think about wandering in, even if you could get through the three steel doors.
A place so cold and remote, it offers unparalleled security, because one day our future might lie in the seeds of the past. Donna Friesen, NBC News, on the Svalbard Archipelago.
It's quite a fascinating complex that's built up there. And you got to understand, this thing is built hundreds of feet into this mountain. It stays at about 0 degrees Fahrenheit, which is below freezing, 32 degrees below freezing. And it probably cost several billion dollars to build. This was not done cheaply. Heavy concrete, steel, security systems, probably monitored by satellite. It is not an easy place to get to. It's definitely someplace that was built at great expense to keep something very, very safe and away from the rest of the world. You know, a seed vault like this could have been built in Colorado. It could have been built under the city of Los Angeles. It could have been built safely in the mountains of Appalachia, but no, it was in a very remote, very cold place of the archipelago. Now, the interesting thing is that it isn't controlled by anyone that can have easy access to it if something does happen. I am encouraged that these are very ancient strains of rice and wheat and corn and all kinds of different crops, over a million different types, in order to protect the history of the world's food supply should we ever have to reset the planet. Currently,
what our country is doing is passing a piece of legislation, which is called Senate Bill S-510. Now, this bill was voted on. It didn't actually become law, voted yes, 73-25 against. This was record vote number 257. But there were pieces in the bill that allowed the government to collect fees for the monitoring and for registering people that were going to grow crops. And this goes all the way down to small farms, $500,000 and more in revenue. But it also, by loophole, by application, can even be extended to the home garden. Yes, that's right. Federal government would have the authority to charge you a fee to record any crop that you produced from your garden if you gave it away or sold it. And it may even extend to your own use. Because you see, the crops that you grow can be close enough to commercial farms as to have an effect to contaminate those farms with something that could be harmful. Now, the real tricky part of this legislation is the word harmful. Because if you introduce a non-GMO strain and it pollinates into a field that has GMO, in effect, you're contaminating a crop which has been federally approved by the FDA. Yeah, that's exactly right. Your non-GMO crop is infecting the GMO crop. Okay? The average annual monetary value of all food sold during the period was less than $500,000 adjusted for inflation. So it should protect small gardens. But there is language here that really makes it dangerous. Senate Bill S-510 has been designed to regulate some of the industrial food measures to help prevent foodborne illnesses, which according to the Centers for Disease Control cause approximately 75 million illnesses each year, including approximately 325,000 hospitalizations and 5,000 deaths. Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat from Iowa, says these numbers are staggering, intolerable, and a call to action. Unfortunately, that call to action is to regulate and create an entire agency for the regulation of the growth of food. Okay? And this is not just packaged food. This also covers non-packaged food. It not only covers exported food, it covers imported food, and it covers food that you would grow in your own garden and sell at a roadside stand, or not even sell, but just give away. So this is how incredibly invasive our government is becoming. And it's not just our government. It's governments that can more easily be manipulated by the billions of dollars of large corporations like Monsanto. And many of these GMO foods are being developed here, but they're being fed to other countries. So this is to developing countries. As you heard in Monsanto's own video, which we ran at the very beginning of this section, it is all about helping the planet bear the burden of feeding the world. But you know that as you fly over our country, as Diane noted earlier, you will see millions and millions and millions of acres of land that is not being farmed. It's not being farmed either because those farmers are broke. They cannot get the funding to put the crops on the land, or they're being paid by the government not to grow crops. They're creating a sort of soil bank as though growing crops would actually harm the soil. They're also you know, manipulating the cost of the crops, keeping them artificially high by limiting the supply. Excuse me? Limiting the supply of food and then turning right around and marketing to us that we need to have these GMO foods in order to feed the world? Something doesn't make any sense here. Why spend all that money to create a seed that requires their pesticide to control, their herbicide to control, spend all that money to create a seed which would be readily available from the last crop that was not GMO, and all we have to do is just plant more in order to feed the world? Because there's another motivation here. There's a motivation to make money off the seed, to make money off the pesticides, to make money off the herbicides, to keep those things in control and growing and looking beautiful, but also to allow the proteins and the genes and the subsequent organisms that can grow off that those proteins and genetic material to limit the size of the human population, to reduce the number of children that women can have, to reduce the lifespan of some developing nations. Now, these are not claims that I'm making, you know, empty-handed here. I have 37 pages that I've just put together this week, and I could probably put together hundreds of pages. And I do have some stuff here from the Institute for Responsible Technology, which is headed up by Jeffrey Smith. I don't have time to go into a lot of it, but I can just tell you that the states and countries do not have the ability to defend themselves against these mega corporations, which are manipulating billions of dollars worth of food, trillion-dollar markets, and really taking over the natural food of the planet. Let's get another opinion. Gail from Tennessee, you're on line one. Welcome to the program. Hello, Gail. I know you're out there.
Well, hello, Dr. Agnew.
There you are.
Interesting topic that you're talking about tonight as far as this this government land program. I happen to speak from experience with my father. He's a large farmer in Kansas. And my father has laid a lot of this ground feral and went into the program where the government pays you not to grow any crops on the land. But I think what a lot of people don't know, and my father got into this and signed all the paperwork. Of course, he's a Masonic Mason anyway, so what difference, you know? He's already set for life. When you sign up with the government, and it's not only here, it's also going on in Europe. If everybody wants to check that out, just Google what do they call it? Land Feral Program. And you'll find just all kinds of information around the world on what they're doing. Anyway, they pay my dad money every year not to grow crops on that land. But what they don't tell you in that very fine print is that you can never get out of this contractual agreement with the federal government. Pretty much, when you sign that contract, the government owns your land forever. They can dictate to you when, where, and how. And if you want out, you have to pay them every penny that they've gave you along the years for letting the land lay feral that they paid you to do. You have to pay all that money back, plus fines and fees. It's kind of like pulling your money out of a 401k early.
You really? So if your dad
didn't know that, did you?
If your dad were to start growing crops on his land again and the federal government found out about it, they could come and make him pay back all the money they've been paying him over the years?
And imprison him, too. That's correct.
Oh, my gosh. Correct. Now, what happens if your dad sells the land and the new owner comes in and decides to grow?
It doesn't matter. It's lifetime of the land. So, basically, what you are doing, of course, you know, going into this, none of this was explained to the farmers. So, pretty much, our government now owns all this land. They dictate how, when, and where. Okay?
Now, couldn't there be, is this on a state level or a federal level?
This is federal.
All right, so there's no
way
the governor...
the state takes federal assistance, subsidies, and that's what this is. This is farmland subsidy. Okay, that's what it's called.
Now, what happens...
And because the states take money, they're not going to buck up against the federal government.
Well, so this is income to your dad, which he is now paying state taxes on, right? State income tax.
Correct. Yeah, rabbit hole runs deep down at Brooks.
So if the state were to sign this this sovereignty act that seems to be going around, I think there's 34 states that have signed on to it. It takes 37 states to make this really happen. But if the state were to say, we want to let our farmers become productive again, we need the economy, and the state decides to let the farmers begin to grow again, to become part of the global economy instead of dependent upon this check, I think it would be the setup of secession.
Correct. That's correct. Federal government's going to get paid, or the states are going to be wiped out. And so I guess it still comes back to that little Russian sociologist professor who said a couple of years ago, and he laid out the map, he sees us breaking up just like the USSR did. I think you're probably going to see, of course, we all know that the state of Texas always has to renew its participation with the federal government on a yearly basis because they are sovereign.
Right. And Texas never signed on back into the Union when the Union was reorganized after the Civil War.
Correct.
Yeah,
and
that's kind of
interesting. The federal government is so deep into the backside pockets of all of our governing bodies of each state that the only way that they succeed is when we go into a civil war. It's the only way I see it.
Well, it's not. It isn't going to be a civil war in the sense like
not
you know.
Not in the sense of what we're thinking of back in the 1800s. No.
But it is going to be a civil war of what I will call nullification. Nullification was a policy that was taken on state by state when we were the states of America, not all one country, but we were actually states participating as a country. That each state. In the South, practiced a legal tactic called nullification, and that was that each federal law that was passed that had to be enforced in the state had to be ratified by that state's legislature before it went into effect. Now, the federal government didn't like that one bit, and that was the main thrust of the war. This act of secession was an act of sovereignty.
It wasn't about slavery, no.
No. That didn't have anything to do with it, and it won't have anything to do with it this time. This time, however, what we need are we need two-thirds of the states, which I think is 37. 37 states signing sovereignty acts, they can then appoint delegates to a constitutional convention, and they can change the Constitution by amending it directly.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know that that territory called Washington, D.C. has no binding right. Their only jurisdiction is in that, 3, 4, 5 square mile area. And if any state goes along with that, it's only by the consent of the governing body of that state that they participate with that corporation.
We're setting up for a very interesting battle lines, so to speak, and I think it's going to be in the courts.
Yes, we are.
Texas.
I'll leave you with this also too. A lot of people may not know while they're out here investigating all this. My father has sold for probably the last 10-15 years for a seed company called GARR, G-A-R-R. And they are one of the subsidiaries of Monsanto. Once my dad began to figure this out in the last couple of years, now he's trying to get out of the whole deal. But, you know, they wined and dined him because he became one of their top salespeople for selling all their corn, genetically modified corn and all this. And now be seeing the devastation that it's caused.
Well, it really has. Some of the corn is grown to make alcohol. Some of it's, which we know has been
ethanol,
a disaster on the world food markets.
Because it's combustible, causes water vaporization in the chambers. And yeah. Ethanol is a disaster.
Well, maybe the Tea Party will throw all this legislation in the harbor.
I know.
What do you say? Let's get America growing again.
I know. We got a bad connection here, so I'll get off the phone and listen on air, but thank you. Great to
All right. Thanks so much, Gail. I like that. Let's get America growing again. Wow. What a great slogan. I think I'll send it to Sarah Palin and see if she can get that into the party. That is not uncommon. Kansas, Washington State, Texas, it's happening all over. I met several farmers up there in Washington State sitting on tens of thousands of acres of the best wheat growing land in the world, and they cannot grow on it. Some of them have even talked about growing grass instead of wheat to see if they can get away with it. They don't like being not productive. It's not American. It is not American to be unproductive like this. What do you say? Get on your Facebooks, your Twitters, write your congressman, your senator. You heard it first right here on X Squared Radio. Let's get America growing again. You remember, we used to feed the world. We used to export. We used to control the world's food supply. We sent the world's best crops all over the world. And countries prospered when our wheat and our corn and our rice and our sorghum arrived on their shores. So, let's keep it going. We got Antonin on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hi, and thanks, Dr. Agnew. Very, very relevant and important topic tonight. Thank you so much for putting it on the plate.
Oh, my pleasure. I thought the first hour with the Chinese debt was powerful, but this GMO foods are really a hot item.
It is another extremely relevant, you know, issue of the day, and I think more than anything, I'm so encouraged to hear so many people phoning in that are aware, you know, of the significance of the issue. And what I wanted to bring to your attention, and you know, I'm not sure if maybe you're already aware of this, Dr. Agnew, but there is a Don Huber, Colonel, retired Don M. Huber, who is professor emeritus at Purdue University, and he had composed a letter. I think it was co-signed by some other folks who are specialists as well, directed to Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack regarding a newly identified pathogen that they think is linked in some fashion to the use of the Roundup Ready gene. Are you familiar with this?
Wow, no, I did not find that in my research. Enlighten me.
Well, once again, I think if you use, you know, a Google search or Yahoo, the individual's name again is Don, D-O-N, middle initial M as in Mary, last name Huber, H-U-B-E-R. He is a retired colonel. Again, as far as I know, he is actively teaching still at Purdue University, and his credentials are impeccable. He's regarded as you know, one of the preeminent soil scientists in the world, frankly, let alone just the United States. And I think you'll find the information interesting. I think I'd rather prefer not to kind of dwell on it here, but you know, perhaps this is something that you can kind of bring to the program at a future time and discuss in more detail.
Yeah, I will do that. We're down to about the last 5 minutes of the program, but I really appreciate the phone call, Anthony. And it's I too am just, you know, thrilled that so many people are informed and so many lives on so many different levels have been touched by this subject. It's it really lends itself to a lot more research than what I've done.
You're absolutely right about that. And so I just want to thank you again for your program in general, but also your topics of this evening. And I've been a follower of your work for a number of years now, and now that I have a newly started program on the same station here, but a little earlier on the day, Sunday afternoon, I'm hoping maybe sometime I could have you stop by and we can compare a few notes on the Crimson Pill.
Absolutely, be delighted to do that. Thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure. Take care, and hopefully have safe travels until the next time we meet.
Same to you, and welcome aboard to the BBS Radio Network.
Thank you, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, well, we have about 3 minutes left. We might be able to squeeze in one more call if you want to call in. We're going to do some more research on this. I'm going to get a couple of experts out there. I think that I want to get to the bottom of this. Maybe we can start some activism. I'm concerned about it because when you know, the old saying, don't mess with Mother Nature. Now, that's not to say that we can't make some improvements. We can. And I'm just saying that that improvements, as long as there is good civilian oversight, and I mean experts like Don M. Huber at Purdue University and others, outside of the economics of Monsanto and the billions of dollars that they control. Not that all that is naturally nefarious, but certainly absolute power corrupts absolutely. And if it's sort of like inventing seatbelts and it's not really selling very well, and so you go have a law passed requiring all cars to have a seatbelt, it's going to be a pretty good payday. If you spend billions of dollars creating a seed that makes a food that is mildly edible, regardless of what effects it has on people's lives, and then you pass a law requiring all people to eat your food, you're going to make a lot of money. Because eating, hey, I've grown the habit. I have to do it every day. Every day I have to do it. I can't believe it. And I face the results of it. You know, I go to the gym, I work out, I run, I eat right, or what I think is right. And yet, I have these pesky few pounds of flab that seem to hang around. Now, I'm in pretty good shape for my age. Those of you that know me know this. But still, I can't help but think that the stuff that I eat is responsible for me looking the way that I do. And when I walk around town, I see a lot of grade A pork on the hoof, if you know what I mean. Americans are fat, but they're not. It's not just Americans. It's everywhere I go, every country I go to. People are increasingly looking like they're eating too much, but they're not. Generally, people are hungry. Wherever you go around the world, they're hungry. They can't get enough to eat. Their shelves are not as full. Their grocery stores are not as full as ours are. They don't have the diversity and the beauty in their stores that we do. And in my travels in Tibet, one of the things that we were cautioned against was eating the raw vegetables because they spray human feces right on the vegetables. That's how they fertilize them. The E. coli that's in the feces goes right on the food. So this is what we have to battle against. You have to cook the food. You got to boil the rice. You got to peel the fruit before you eat it. Anything that is raw, you can't eat. And it's becoming that way whether we cook our food or not, because the genetics have been altered to the point that our bodies have not been given the time to adapt to this new kind of protein. So we have completely run out of time, and I've got to give a chance for the next host to come on. I can't believe we've gone through 3 hours this quickly. I appreciate all the calls more than you know. I appreciate you listening. We will be back next week with more X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, here every Sunday evening between 5 and 8 Pacific time. Thank you so much. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.